Well, welcome back to another episode of Parker's Pensies. This is a podcast where we explore thoughts in philosophy, theology, nature, and life. I love thinking about cool stuff, so come think with me. If you guys like this at all, if you like the show, if you like the podcast, then please consider leaving me a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. Leave me a comment. Let me know what you think of the episode. I will follow up on those for now until they get too crazy. Some of you guys are already too crazy, but I will still follow up with you. Thanks for supporting the show on Patreon and Anchor and all that good stuff. Appreciate you guys and appreciate all the support and all the thoughts and ideas. You guys are awesome. Today is a really fun episode. It's like a couple years in the making here. For me, I have with me Paul Vanderclay, and we're going to be talking about the meaning crisis, whether there still is a meaning crisis or not. Jordan Peterson, his answer to it, and some C.S. Lewis. So right in my wheelhouse and also right in Paul's wheelhouse. So I'm really, really excited for this episode. So without further ado, let's bring him in. Paul, thanks so much for coming on the podcast, man.
It's great to be here.
Yeah. The wisdom beard, by the way, is looking great. I know you're talking about that in one of your recent episodes, but the longer it gets, the more wisdom you have.
Yeah, it just grows and grows and grows. I mean, it would take over everything. And so then at some point, it's like, the whole purpose of a beard is so that I don't have to shave. Mm-hmm. And then once it gets too long, then it's like, I have to groom it. It's like, I can't do that. So then I cut it off again. And it just keeps growing back.
I love that. So Paul, can you explain for those who don't know, you are unfamiliar with your project, can you just explain for us what is it that you're up to?
That's a good question. I don't always know. I started on this. Okay. So I'm a pastor of a small local church in the Christian Reformed Church, which is a Dutch Calvinist denomination. And I was a foreign missionary before this. My father was a Christian Reformed minister. My grandfather was a Christian Reformed minister. So we've been in this business for generations. My father's church was sort of a racial reconciliation church back in the 60s and 70s, back in when that's what racial reconciliation was back in the 60s and 70s. And then I came into this church in the 90s, and it's just been working a small local ministry. I've always been interested in thoughts and ideas. I kept a blog for a long time. I still do. I still have it. And my blog is basically my filing cabinet. Pastors keep filing cabinets because we have to keep illustrations and ideas for sermons.
That's right.
And along the way, I decided to use a blog for my filing cabinet because I could access it anywhere. I could take things from anywhere and throw it into the blog. And also other pastors would have access to it. And so I would do writing projects and all kinds of things on my blog. And a number of times I thought about getting serious about writing a book. But each time I would get closer to that, I reflected on the fact that almost nobody in my congregation read books, but they did watch TV, and so I started playing around with YouTube and videos. I started the Freddie and Paul show with a member of my church which I still do on my channel. And then I found Jordan Peterson, and I really wanted to interact with his ideas. I had been reading Rod Dreher's blog for quite a while, Rod Dreher and Andrew Sullivan and a whole bunch of different bloggers. And I really liked how they were able to take what was going on in the world and sort of bring it into the blog and chew on it and come to some conclusions. And I sort of wondered if that would be possible with video. Mm-hmm. And I was very interested in the work of Jordan Peterson. And I thought, well, how can I? So I'd blogged about it a little bit, but that didn't seem to work. I tried talking to friends about it, but who's going to sit and listen to how many hours of video unless you're really motivated to, which I was. And so I thought, I wonder if I could just use a screen capture program and sort of blogify commentary on what Jordan Peterson is talking about. Mm-hmm. So I made a video. And I had, I think, 15 YouTube subscribers, and most of them were people who wanted to. I would sometimes record my sermons and throw them up because people would miss one. Or the Freddie and Paul show, which was mostly Freddie's mom wanted to see it, Freddie wanted to see it, so I'd throw it up on YouTube. And then I did this video about Jordan Peterson. And the next day I had, you know, over 100 subscribers. And the day after that I had 300 subscribers. And it was like, well, this is strange. Mm-hmm. And what I mostly wanted out of the project were some conversation partners. because I wanted to talk about what I thought was interesting and important. And I discovered that YouTube could be a good platform for this. So I kept making videos and I kept reading the comments and I kept having conversation partners. And then I'd start getting people from Sacramento who said, you know, we should really do a meetup so we can talk about these ideas because I don't have anybody to talk about them with. So I'm a pastor of a local church. I have a space. So, okay, let's do a meetup. And a dozen people showed up the first time. And as a pastor of a small, dramatically unsuccessful Reformed church, I found that to be a revelation. I thought 12 random strangers will show up to talk about Jordan Peterson. And the next month I did it again. And another, you know, 10, 12, 15 new people showed up. And I thought, well, this is interesting. So, and then people who didn't live in Sacramento wanted to talk to me about it. And so I was having conversations on Skype and Zoom and things like that. And I began to wonder, I bet you other people would like to engage in this conversation too. So I started, when appropriate, I would ask if they would be willing to let me record it. And then if the conversation was appropriate, I asked if they'd be willing to let me post it on my YouTube channel. And some people said yes. So I started posting that. And then more people started watching, not just for the commentary and the conversations, but they wanted to be part of the conversation. So I'd record those. And then the local meetup guys said, we really need to have a Discord server. So we started one of those. So we had that. And I also continued to use, you know, my earlier videos were mostly about Jordan Peterson. But then I thought, you know, the way I used to use my blog, which was sort of an avenue for thinking out loud, I should just keep doing that with YouTube and see if anybody cares or wants to watch. And in fact, people kept watching that. And so my YouTube channel is sort of has three things as commentaries on Jordan Peterson or other people on the internet that I think on YouTube often that I think are important that I'd like to make comments about what they've put on. And that's sort of expanded into books. I do some reading and commenting on books now on my YouTube channel. And then monologue videos where I'm thinking out loud about something and basically invite my audience to think with me. So, you know, I read the comments or at least as many as I can get to to get a sense of that. And then the conversations. And that's what I've been doing now for 3 years. And it's continued to grow. And for me, in terms of my church work, there's this great passage in the New Testament where the Apostle Paul rents out the hall of Tyrannus. And I think it's in Corinth. It's in Corinth or Ephesus. I'm pretty sure it's in Corinth. And you get the sense that Paul rents out this hall. And what he does is sort of what happened at Athens in the Areopagus, where Paul just talks to people and lectures. And this gets noted in the book of Acts. And, you know, I was always amazed how we got all these Christians reading the book of Acts. Why? I've never heard a sermon on it. I've never heard anybody comment on this, but this seemed to be integral for the way the Apostle Paul engaged his culture. Mm-hmm. And one of the problems I've had with church is it seemed to me that for many people, church was the last place they might imagine that they could go to pursue a free, open-ended conversation where they could say heretical things, share whatever thought was on their mind, and just honestly explore the things that they were talking about. Mm-hmm. And as a pastor for a number of years, one of the things I began to notice with church small groups and things like that is that people in churches regularly get shamed for giving wrong answers.
Right.
That's a really bad thing for a church. Mm-hmm. Not that wrong answers are good, but that for all of us, the process of learning and discovery requires us to share what we think. And in fact, in our educational system, you give a test, and the most important thing about a test is often the wrong answers. Get those questions wrong so the teacher can come and correct them. Well, people aren't necessarily that correctable, but I wanted a much more open space for conversation and discussion about what mattered most to people. And the church was the last place that this could happen. And pastors were some of the last people that people would approach for these conversations. And I thought, this is counterproductive to the work of the church. And via my videos and the meetups and my interest in Jordan Peterson and the interest that he has developed, I found that I could use myself as a pastor, I could use church space to actually have significant conversations with people. And in my opinion, as an outreach effort, it's far more effective than Vacation Bible School or, you know, trunk-a-treat things. I mean, how many of these church events do we hold, which are of, you're never going to get a person to actually get anywhere near what we'd like to do with a person, which is actually have a meaningful conversation about the most important things in life. We're going to give them candy, or we're going to get them junk food or hot dogs or a free babysitting and all those things. That's okay. Yeah. But what I really want to do is get to the conversation, and via YouTube and meetups and Discord, I get to the conversation a whole lot faster. And to me, and my conversation partners are a whole lot broader. So for me, this was a far more effective evangelistic project than all of this stupid stuff that churches wind up doing. So that is my project.
Yeah. Well, that's huge. I'm so glad that you went into that, because it also helps me clarify my project as well. And I started my blog back in 2016. Because I would get all these questions from the students I was discipling. I was working for this, still working for this campus ministry. And I thought, you know what? I answered this question via text like 12 times. I'm going to write it up. I could thumbs. And then I'll write it up to you. Sorry about that, Paul. Are you there?
That's okay.
There we go.
I'm still here.
Yeah. I'll edit that. So I started the blog because I was answering all these questions again and again with my thumbs. I thought I could type this a little bit better, think it through. And then that kind of turned into exactly what you said, where it was a file cabinet for all of my thoughts. And like before this conversation, I just read a research paper I wrote on Jordan Peterson for Religion in the Modern World. And I refer to that every time I talk about Peterson, because that was the best way I've ever thought about it. I read through Maps of Meaning in a couple months, and I analyzed it the way I would analyze it best. And so it's been super duper helpful. And then, yeah, having these conversations with people like you, trying to get your ideas out there to a broader audience. Right? So Paul, our projects are similar. I love the conversations that you're starting. When it comes to like the meaning crisis, I think that's probably what has, you tell me, man, did Peterson get famous because there was a meaning crisis, or did he get famous kind of on his own and then that exposed a meaning crisis? What do you think about that?
I think Peterson got attention because he violated a public orthodoxy, a new public orthodoxy. He dared to challenge it. But then when people discovered him, they discovered that his message was very clearly addressing a meaning crisis, especially among men. Now, Peterson never used that meaning crisis language. That meaning crisis language comes from John Vervaeke, who's a colleague of Jordan Peterson, who, you know, I've been in conversation with, because Vervaeke and some of his partners, Christopher Mastropietro and some others, were looking in the culture and said, there is in fact a meaning crisis. And this is, in many ways, women biologically have a little leg up in this, because once you have a baby, a woman has carried that baby for 9 months, and everything biological in that woman is focusing on the survival of that child. Mm-hmm. And so right there, there's an enormously meaningful endeavor that if a woman gets pregnant and keeps the child, she will in fact, that will launch her in a journey. Men don't have that advantage. Mm-hmm. Men's, you know, if once we hit as a culture a point in which survival could be almost assured, men no longer had a biological impetus towards certain kinds of meaningful activities. Mm-hmm. And in fact, a lot of the things in our culture have been pointing men away from meaningful activities. And this has, especially among young men, caused what I think is a meaning crisis. Mm-hmm. And Jordan, with his emphasis on responsibility, awakened that, because he could, in a very compelling way, challenge young men to stop being self-indulgent, mm-hmm. and even worse, self-pitying, and take up heavy things and try to do something with their lives. And that really struck a chord for a lot of people. And it was also interesting. I mean, and Peterson mapped a lot of this out with maps of meaning in terms of how this is to work. But it's not, you know, Peterson by no means was the first person to hit on this. You know, and the evangelical world had been seeing this for a long time. You look at the whole Promise Keepers movement. Right. Promise Keepers movement very much addressed the meaning crisis among evangelical men and challenged men to not simply use women for sexual pleasure, but to commit, and pointed them to the fact that to be a man means being able to not only be strong, but focus your strength and harness your strength towards much longer term good ends.
Yeah.
And some of the most challenging good ends we can find for men are commitment to one woman, marriage, family, all sorts of things that, you know, conservative Christians all across the board have been prioritizing for a very long time, which increasingly the culture tends to discard.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I've noticed, man, you helped me think through this so well, but I've noticed since I work with college athletes that it hits us after college, whereas it might hit some of the general population a little bit earlier, especially amongst wrestlers. And I work primarily with wrestlers, but we still have that kind of single focused goal of, you know, we kind of know what it means to be a man for ourselves, right? It means being on top of the podium, which is not exactly what it means to be a man. But when you're done with that, now you spent your whole life, I started wrestling since first grade. And now who am I? What am I? Am I still a man? And so I found my identity in Christ, but I still straight up wrestle with the idea of what does it mean to be a man almost every single day.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, and that makes perfect sense with athletes, because an athlete is doing something extremely meaningful, extremely biological, mm-hmm. extremely intense. And within the realm of athletic competition, all of those factors are in play. Mm-hmm. Once you leave there, what does the world tell you to do? And right now, there's a lot of signals being sent to men that basically says, sit down, shut up, don't do anything, yeah. wait until you're told. It's not an exactly meaningful context in which to act. Now, for a very long time in our industrialized society, men have had to sort of, John Vervaeke uses this word, exaptation, where now suddenly maybe all of this ambition and energy and drive can be focused into ministry or business or, you know, even into family, you know, building a home, building a career, building a place where, you know, where life can happen, where people can strive. But athletes who have been focused on doing it individually, physically, or as a team, they're going to have to work a transition that gets that basically all of that mental stuff is going to have to be repurposed probably towards much more theoretical and less physical means. And but again, our culture over the last while has pretty much been discouraging men to do that. And when you do that, you're setting men up for a real crisis. And so it shouldn't be a surprise that something like video games mm-hmm. would become, you know, I'm not against video games per se, but they can become a huge trap for men.
Yeah.
And there are lots of these traps around, but video games are a big one, especially for men, because they do the exaptation of our brain. And okay, now we're playing Call of Duty or Fortnite or all of these things where mentally, you know, we're acting like athletes and warriors, yeah. But physically we're sitting there like this.
Right. Yeah. Paul, I don't know. I hope this isn't too graphic or anything, but it's like, well, maybe I shouldn't say it, but I'm going to say it. It's like masturbation. And then you're not incentivized to go out and find a wife and right. to go procreate.
Right.
It's the same kind of thing happening, though. You know, I don't play video games myself. A lot of my friends do, but that's the point you're getting at when you do it to that extent and you're filling that mean void with video games. That's what's up.
That's right. That's right. That's exactly right.
Yeah. So yeah, it's so interesting. After college, I got really into caring for animals. So I got some giant African bullfrogs. And I made a video. It's got 37 million views now. And part of,
I have to look that up.
Yeah, it's crazy. Part of the podcast is to redeem myself. So that's not my legacy to the world. It's just a bunch of stupid frogs. But
frogs aren't stupid. God made frogs.
True.
Jesus
true.
Died for frogs. He really did. And I say those things that people look at me, what do you mean Jesus died for frogs? Well, Jesus died for this world, for God so loved the world. The world includes frogs. So don't feel too embarrassed about your African frog video.
Thanks, man. I appreciate that. I got into that. And it was kind of caring for something with my hands. You know, there were a lot of work and that was nice. And then Peterson told me to clean my room. So I kind of did that. My wife is a little bit happy about that. I still am working on that aspect of the Petersonian ideology. But I wanted to ask you, so even though the meaning crisis isn't part of his language, how does he address the meaning crisis?
He addresses it when he makes responsibility so central to his missional message to the world. And you hear them say this all the time. When he says, when I get up in front of an audience and I talk about responsibility, the theater, there's a hush in the theater. And so he's recognizing that. And if you look at the core of his message is that meaning is sort of an internal gyroscope. Do what is one of his most important rules for life is do what is meaningful, not what is expedient. Because meaning is sort of this internal gyroscope that can point you in a right direction. The problem with meaning is that there is many activities in the world can be meaningful. Mm-hmm. Not every meaningful activity, in fact, is in alignment with the Creator's will for the world or the Redeemer's will for the world. So that's the weakness of Jordan Peterson's sort of gyroscopic truthiness method. That, well, there's a lot of people pursuing meaningful activities in the world. Doesn't mean that they're good.
Yeah. Well, and that's what I found helpful about Lewis's first and second things. You can make a lot of second things into meaningful things, but I've heard it from Olympic gold medalists. They get the gold medal and they're like, well, what now is the loneliest night of my entire life? And it's because you treated a second thing as if it was a first thing. What I found really helpful in Peterson's language, though, is that when Christian pastors talk about happiness and we want to denigrate happiness because it comes and goes, and that's good. I like that. But they always throw in joy. And it doesn't, for me as a man, as a wrestler, I'm like, dude, our conception of joy in this culture is not very masculine. It's not very exciting to me. But if you said meaning instead of happiness, I can get on board with that because my whole life was about pursuing meaning, even when I don't feel happy. And so I've been really excited about that. What do you think about the relation between meaning and joy? Is Peterson saying the same thing we're saying, or is it a little bit different?
I would first differentiate between happiness and joy.
Mm-hmm.
For C.S. Lewis, joy was something that was definitely not mere happiness. Because joy for Lewis especially was often something tinged with nostalgia. Mm-hmm. And also in the gospel, joy is something that can also be coupled with suffering. And I think when joy and suffering, you know, for example, the book of Hebrews talks about, well, why did Christ pursue? We were his meaningful quarry. I mean, humanity, fallen, broken humanity was his meaningful quarry. Why did he pursue us? He pursued us out of joy. And so I think joy is actually a better term, because I think joy and meaning are not, can't in any way be sort of set against each other. Mm-hmm. Whereas Peterson is right when he says happiness is a fine thing, but meaning trumps happiness. And every woman that has a child, every man that goes to war, you know, they have the child for meaning and joy. Childbirth and child raising, happy sometimes, not happy other times. Right. And so that I would differentiate happiness from joy there, because joy is a far deeper thing that can in fact include and often must include suffering. And that's where it connects up with meaning, because meaning often includes suffering.
Yeah. Yeah. Often. Yeah. Like the more suffering you go through to accomplish something, the more worthwhile it is. Or
that's right.
And I was just reading, Beyond Order. And he's talking about this in one of his rules. Or I think about collecting things. I love collecting books and stuff like that. And if you find a first edition that's really rare, it was hard to get and it gave it more value, more meaning.
That's right.
So then how about for Peterson, would you say you can't have joy without meaning?
Yeah, I would say that. Okay, I think meaning is integral to joy.
Okay. So if you stop at joy, or if you stop at meaning, and you're more of a stoic kind of person, I think sometimes Peterson sounds a little bit stoic, which is okay. I kind of like that too. Should we push him to, has he not reached the pinnacle? Is joy the pinnacle and maybe meaning's the ground level and he needs to continue up? Or is he saying the exact same thing that we're saying?
No, I think you're right. So Jordan will say, find something heavy to carry. Mm-hmm. Drag that heavy cross up to the top of the hill. And so I did. Rebel Wisdom, the guys from Rebel Wisdom came to California and did a little interview with me. And I said exactly what you said right now. I said, Peterson is really has a stoicism about him. Hmm. What's on top of, pick up that heavy cross and drag it up the hill. And what's at the top of the hill? And so then actually David Fuller from Rebel Wisdom had an interview with Peterson, and Peterson said, well, tell Paul Vanderclay, you know, the kingdom of God or the city of God is at the top of the hill. And I thought, that's right. Mm-hmm. The city of God. But, and his recent conversation with Peugeot really brought this out.
Yeah.
You're going to have difficulty even at least mentally realizing what the direction of that is until you understand who is the king of the city of God.
Mm.
And you're going to have a part of the line that Peterson is struggling with is that he understands. I thought there was a UK, he's now a priest, used to be an Anglican priest, but you know, he said, and he also was quite well versed in Jung. He said, you know, for Peterson, Jesus is still an archetype.
Yeah.
But the, you know, part of what Christianity asserts, and Peterson is so close to this, is that the logos, the archetype, gets made flesh.
Mm-hmm.
And what is integral to Christianity with that is if, when the archetype is made flesh, when the logos is made flesh, that means that we too can incarnate the archetype. Mm-hmm. We too can, the logos can inhabit us. Yeah. You know, and in John 1, not 1 John 1, but the Gospel of John chapter 1, the prologue of the Gospel of John, you know, the Word was made flesh and tabernacled among us.
Right.
That's what the text says. Mm-hmm. And that's what Christianity says. And so Peterson is right there asking, how far can we go to appropriate the Logos? And a Christian can say, it was done perfectly in Jesus Christ.
Mm-hmm.
And if that has happened, that then energizes his followers to drag that cross up the hill with a much fuller knowledge, you know, pursuing joy, but with a much fuller knowledge about how far it can happen. And I understand Peterson's pessimism and disappointment in Christians and the church. For other people at seminary, so before I did any of this, I worked with a lot of church planters, and church planters are a really fun group of people because they're idealistic, and they basically look around and they say, you know, I've never been in a church that has really fully satisfied me. So I'm going to plant a church that really fully satisfies me. And when people come, young men come to me and say they want to do that, I say, you go for it. You go to it. You pour yourself into that meaningful, joyful activity about planting that church. And invariably 5, 10, 15 years later, I'll talk to them and they're like, yeah, but it still disappoints me. Yeah. Well, now welcome to Calvinism. You know, we in this age, we only get so far up that hill. I get that.
Yeah.
But Peterson is right that the pursuit of it is fundamental. But the thing that a Christian has is he can say, you know what? We are going to get there.
Yeah.
We are going to get there. We really are. And if it's just an archetype, if it's just an idea, if it's just a pattern, you have no promise of getting there. And that's exactly why the physicality and the historicity of the resurrection are integral.
Yeah.
And why, as Jonathan Peugeot laid out for Peterson, this is why Christians keep insisting, if the resurrection is just a really cool story, that gives me no hope that I'll get there.
Yeah.
And so knowledge that you will get there makes the pursuit of getting there all the more passionate and joyful and can really mobilize us to get there.
Yes. I love that. That idea that the veil has been torn and, you know, the world as a forum for action has met the world of things in Christ, in the Logos coming down, and it actually happened. And we have someone, we have the Holy Spirit living inside us, encouraging us to go on. We can smile. I forgot who said it. Maybe it's Nietzsche or maybe Bertrand Russell thought about Sisyphus rolling up the hill and thought, we have to think of him smiling. And that's us if we're dragging our cross up the hill, because we can look to Christ and we can smile, knowing that we're not trying to instantiate the true hero and ride the wave of order and chaos by ourselves.
Right.
But we have someone who's done it. And he is the archetype, and it gets me all fired up. But what I do like about Peterson, about what you've done in drawing out Peterson's idea, is the idea of carrying the cross in Christianity, at least in evangelical Christianity I grew up in, was always a nice little thing. You know, hey, you got to carry your cross. And it's like, well, if you think about that, it's a torture device. It is really hard. And we're following the crucified Savior. And it is he draws out the burden and how the burden is meaningful.
It's a torture device imposed upon you by your enemies.
Mm.
And that is something, I mean, it was blatantly obvious to the Christians in the first century up until the third or the fourth century, when crucifixion was finally abolished, basically because Jesus, in a lot of ways within the Christian world, destroyed the cross.
Right.
They could never again use a cross unironically.
Yeah.
And so, but that is what a cross is. It's the torture device imposed upon you by your religious, political, and cultural enemies. Mm-hmm. And Jesus says, you embrace that cross and you carry it.
Yeah.
Not to, you know, if we were to take the Marvel Cinematic Universe and use those values to replicate the story of Jesus, Jesus would have, in that, you know, once they had the cross, Jesus would have risen up, wielded that cross, and bludgeoned his enemies on his way up to Golgotha.
Right.
And Jesus does not do that. And again, if you get rid of the Jesus of power that the Gospels clearly want to articulate for us, mm-hmm. it's not that he couldn't do that.
Right.
He doesn't do that. And that gets pointed to right there at the crucifixion, because, you know, the New Testament is so brief and the Gospel accounts are so short. They're really booklets in a lot of ways.
Mm-hmm.
But the one thing that makes the cut in terms of what Jesus' adversaries said to him was mockery. He saved others. He cannot save himself. And right there in that is the point that, no, he is saving others by not saving himself.
Yeah.
He can. He can come down from that cross. He could, just like, you know, the Hulk or Thor or Superman, he could whip up that cross, use it to beat up those who put him on it. Mm-hmm. And that's what our culture says. Yeah. Jesus won't do it. And the church, still, that's a really hard thing for us to finally get our heads around and then embrace how Jesus acts in his culture war.
Yeah, that's such a great point. And I think for different reasons, people more on the left side want to see Jesus as my boyfriend, Jesus, or Jesus as so unbelievably meek that he was carried, you know, against his will to the cross, and look at poor Jesus. And the other side,
Jesus is the victim, and Jesus was a victim.
Yeah.
But that's not, he was not only a victim.
It's not the full story. Yeah.
That's right.
And the other side is Jesus, you know, he turned over tables too. You know, Jesus got angry and he was righteous indignation. Well, yeah, of course, for sure. But yeah, you have the lion of the tribe of Judah clawing his way to the cross because of the joy set before him. And the one who holds the universe together, including the cross that he was hung on, who could have, I like to talk to my students about if he would have sneezed and just had like one instance of like, ow, this hurts, you know, one instance of weakness, he's exploding the universe.
Yeah.
You know, and I would have, you know, but he doesn't because he's so strong. He's such a strong, and that's another point that Peterson brought out, that you're not noble if you are just weak and unable to do harm, but you're actually more noble if you're able to do great harm and you restrain yourself.
That's right.
And we have that perfect example in the archetypal God man, you know, the archetypal man, Christ, who came down for us. And that's why it's like, Peterson, man, just keep going. You know?
Yeah. He's right there. But you have to, again, you, and many Christians within the church are actually where Peterson is, you know, well, they're just saying the right things. Yeah. Peterson has an understanding of what this leap will cost him, but you do it. You surrender, you finally surrender to Christ.
Yeah.
And you know, my favorite short definition of Christianity is someone who trusts Jesus more than they trust themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Because finally you say, okay, if I am my own savior and Lord, I've got really a lousy one and I need a savior and Lord that is better than myself. And so Jesus, I will trust in you. I will follow you.
Yeah. Yeah, I say something similar because this is where the point that he brought me to. Just, I'll go wherever you want me to go. I'll say whatever you want me to say, and I'll do whatever you want me to do.
Sure.
Because I've tried it myself. And I do what you said about Peterson's right, where I quoted it in my paper. He said, you know, I'm scared. He didn't say he's scared, but he was nervous to admit God's existence because of the cost and because he takes it so seriously. And I thought, how many Christians ought to be feeling that way? To say that I'm an image bearer of God means when I go and kick my dog out of anger, I'm telling that dog that God's a dog kicker and he kicks dogs in unrighteous anger. Yep. It's just terrifying. You know, imagine thinking that without the gospel, but then even more so, I'm a Christian. I represent Christ everywhere. I'm supposed to be saying, look, this is what Christ is like. I'm a little Christ. And that's terrifying to say that. It's hard, but yeah, this is just things that Peterson's helped kind of draw out, which I think is really helpful for the church. Paul, so how did Lewis address the meaning crisis? I know he was before this, perhaps, right?
He wasn't before the meaning crisis.
Okay,
Lewis had an enormous meaning crisis that he needed help to get out of. And he got that help out of it via Tolkien, Dyson, and his conversion to Christianity.
Mm-hmm.
The meaning crisis. So I like to describe the meaning crisis in this way. On one hand, through the Enlightenment, bit by bit, but especially the peak of modernity really climaxed just before the First World War. And what we began to learn about the world outside of ourselves was the world is much more complex than we thought it was. And there's all this cause and effect that's going on. And so modernity is all about closing one eye of the manifest image so you can see through the scientific image, closing the one eye and saying, okay, the world has a whole bunch of cause and effect relationships. All right. Now, so one aspect is, wow, the world is really complex and deep and mysterious. And we don't have anywhere near the handle on it that we thought we did. And the other element of the meaning crisis is, we are part of this world because what happens in modernity is we close one eye and we see the world and we say, I think I can see the world as it is. And so then we learn we can't see the world as it is. And then we begin to see ourselves and say, all those cause and effect relationships are in me. And we start to lose the self itself. So Lewis, of course, I've just started reading another Lewis biography. There are lots of good biographies about Lewis, and anybody who wants to understand Lewis, read a bunch of his biographies. But so Lewis, you know, grows up in this home, and his mother dies. His father is a good man. He loves him. He's not terribly able to be a good father in a lot of ways, but he's a hard worker and he's a smart guy, and he does encourage young Jack. But he doesn't really know how to raise his sons. And then Lewis's mother dies when he's six. And his father doesn't know what to do. So he sends the boys off to boarding school. And it's a horrible boarding school. And Lewis, in some ways, never forgives his father for that. But Lewis, who initially, you know, was immensely brilliant, of course, but also quite interested in mythology, basically has mythology crushed out of him and uses it as sort of a meaningful escape, sort of analogous to what video games are today. And he gives up Christianity at a very young age and becomes sort of a hard-bitten atheist. And his one of his greatest teachers,
Kirkpatrick,
is also a hard-bitten atheist. And so Lewis sort of doubles down in that. And then, of course, Lewis has to go off and fight in the First World War, and he has exactly the right kind of injury that saves his life, and has to spend most of the war in a hospital. And then he takes up with the mother of a buddy of his who was killed in the war, and, you know, eventually winds up getting a university position as a tutor at Oxford. But Lewis and Tolkien both really have this enormous meaning crisis caused by the First World War. And they have to find their way out of it. And the way they find their way out of it is story. And that's why Lewis and Tolkien, I mean, Tolkien, probably the greatest storyteller of the 20th century in the English language. They have to figure out their way out of it. And for Lewis, it happens. And Peterson points this out in his conversation with Peugeot. Well, actually later Peterson tweeted this essay that Lewis writes of the myth becoming fact.
Finally, Peterson. Yeah,
that's right. Right. I'm glad you found it.
You're right.
But that is the point. And so Lewis, in many ways, one of my favorite Lewis books is one of his apologetics books, Miracles,
favorite book. Yeah.
Yeah. I think it's a terrific book because in that book, that entire book is basically how he walks himself out of his meaning crisis in the middle of the 20th century. Yeah. That's what that book is about. And I think for that reason, Lewis is a very helpful guide in addressing the meaning crisis and in the foreword to another book that I just recently found, which was something I'd never known that Lewis had written. It was the introduction. It was a book about heaven and earth. I found it when I was working on some of the Peugeot stuff, but Lewis had an introduction to that book and I read it and I thought he just lays out the meaning crisis and that introduction so perfectly. He just lays it right out. And so it's obvious that he was wrestling with it. And, you know, so once I started working on the meaning crisis stuff, it became apparent that many Christians are by no means in the midst of a meaning crisis like those who have rejected the church and the gospel. And, you know, even John Vervaeke, who is in many ways post-Christians, he's a non-theist, but very, you know, a very good conversation partner, very fair, very generous. He left Christianity. You can look at some videos that he's described that himself. But, you know, he's noted in his attempt to try and find a religion that is not a religion, his entire project is about addressing the meaning crisis. But he will acknowledge that for many people going into an established religion like Christianity, you will find relief from your meaning crisis. Mm-hmm. But they're just identifying as a Christian or being a part of the church might not quite do it for you in terms of your experience of a meaning crisis if you understand what's going on. And in fact, some areas of the church are sandbagging, especially young men. And I think this is part of the reason why increasingly some of the only churches we're going to find men in are going to be more conservative, you know, Protestant churches or some of the more ancient churches like the Orthodox and the Roman Catholic.
Yeah.
Because what's happening in our culture is simply accentuating the meaning crisis for men. That's part of the dynamic that we're seeing.
Yeah, man. Were you thinking Preface to Paradise Lost?
No. The book is, it's a book that I had never heard about. I came across it. Someone in a comment might have initiated it. I'll just pull up my Kindle library here a second. And the Hierarchy of Heaven and Earth by D.E. Harding. The introduction, I found the introduction by Lewis to be absolutely incredible.
Yeah.
And I read it in one of my videos, because if you read that introduction, it's like, there's the meaning crisis.
Yeah.
Lewis lays the whole thing out. Mm-hmm. And the book itself didn't get much traction. I'm not sure how good a book it is. And Harding went into some very interesting, you know, unusual paths, but Lewis's introduction in that book is, and you can just go to Amazon, you know, get the sample, because the entire introduction's in the sample and you don't have to buy the book.
That's great.
So,
yeah. Wow. Well, Paul, so Lewis wrote this, this essay, which was the precursor to Miracles, called De Futilitate. And he's talking to a group of men who are facing this meaning crisis because of the Second World War, and they're about to go off. And it's very similar to, it's very similar to learning in wartime. You know, what's the point of learning if all our friends are dying and this whole world's, Hitler's going to blow up the whole world? What's the purpose? And he develops the argument from reason, as it's come to be known, which he develops in the first four chapters or six chapters, plus 12 and 13 in Miracles. And I've thought the argument from desire and morality, well, morality different, but desire, his lived ontological proof, doesn't work unless it's true. And that's what Lewis delves into in Miracles. He's saying,
proof works unless it's true.
Right.
That's proof should work unless it's true.
That's
by
right.
definition of the word.
That's
proof.
A good point. Well, so I'm desiring something, and so there might be another world that I'm supposed to be made for. But Lewis develops and he says, look, the fact that we're self-conscious shows that naturalism is a philosophy for boys, as he says elsewhere, but also that it's a pointing towards God. It's another argument for him, the fact that you can reason at all. Where Peterson takes the self-consciousness to say, you know, it's a myth of when we snapped into self-consciousness and we recognize our own futility, our own that we're naked. We're naked apes. That we are vulnerable. Our own vulnerability. I wonder what role does truth play in the meaning crisis?
Lewis's argument from desire, I find very parallel to the ontological argument.
Yeah.
One of the things that, so John Vervaeke is a cognitive scientist. And one of the things that cognitive science, which of course Peterson delves in a lot to with his psychology, one of the things that cognitive science has revealed about us is that we're very bad at truth. Human beings are very bad at truth. And part of the reason, and you can find this in the Bible all over the place, especially in the book of Job. You know, the conclusion to the book of Job is basically Job is screaming throughout the book, "I want a hearing." And God finally says, "All right." And okay, Job, you school me. Can you really school me? And that's part of the difficulty we have with truth, is that truth is bigger than us. And we are quite small. We are quite short-lived. In order for us, and this is, if you listen to Jordan Peterson's first conversation with Sam Harris and those four videos.
The pragmatist conversation.
Vancouver one. Peterson basically continues to hammer Sam Harris on, hey, look, everything we know about cognitive science and philosophy right now basically says that the world is too big. And the way that human beings actually manage to work productively in the world is we have to scale it down into much smaller, lower resolution chunks in order to actually engage with it productively. So that's us. And what that means is we're always going to have problems with the truth. We're all, our view is always limited. It's always small. And, you know, it's interesting how many times the psalmist talks about this was too wonderful for me. Well, what does the psalmist mean by that? This is, it's too big for me. It's too hard for me. We can't do this. And the ancients knew this. And part of what happens in modernity is our, you know, we get too big for our britches, basically.
Right.
And so Christians go around talking about the truth in ways that they can't live out. And that's, I think, part of the reason Peterson looks at the church and Christians and says, I'm a little skeptical. It might be better if Christians start majoring in humility and living out the truth as best we can. And that isn't to say we should, you know, again, if a close reading of the New Testament reveals a number of things. Number one, we are judged by God according, really, our allegiance and our works. Those are the two things that keep getting, that Jesus keeps bringing up when he has these little judgment day talks. You know, whether you do what I say and, you know, whether you're faithful and loyal to me. And another piece of that is that we never fully measure up here. We always, and this is what I think Calvinism gets right, we always stumble, we always fail. And so finally we are saved by grace. And Christians have to figure out how to embody that message in their lives. And I think if we do so, we'll probably get further along in terms of presenting a compelling witness to this world rather than running around talking about this truth that we have that we can't really live out.
That's helpful. It reminds me of another Lewis essay, Meditation in a Tool Shed. And it was what you talked about earlier, and you did this and this. And the closing of either eye, the moderns say, the moderns want to reject the first person perspective. Let's get to the objective truth, the third person perspective. And that's the world as a place of things. And that's what Lewis talks about, looking at the beam and you can see the fibers, the light, and you can study that. And then the postmoderns want to look along the beam and they want to see what you can see by it. And they want to focus on the first person perspective and neglect the third. We can't know the third. And sometimes I think Christians argue as moderns. And they say that this is the truth and we can all know it. And we can grasp reality. And that's the facts of the matter, ma'am. And that's that.
Right.
And I don't think, I think we need both perspectives in a Lewisian fashion. But then Thomas Nagel writes The View from Nowhere. And he says the exact same thing. Reality is bigger than objective reality. It just blows my mind to think about that. And that's kind of our Christian heritage anyways, that we should have been holding on to.
I talk about it in terms of a monarchical vision. What modernity suggests is that we can possess a monarchical vision. Well, what's a monarchy? Is one, mono. Monoarchy. I mean, you're studying Greek. So mono is one. Arche is both first and principle. You know, arche, typos, archetype, yep. monarchy. I mean, all these words come from the Greek.
That's cold.
And so people imagine that they can have a monarchical vision and they can see the world as it is. Oh, really? I'm skeptical. You can't, because what happens when you do this is you forget that, and Peugeot puts this very well, you're a pattern looking at patterns.
Mm-hmm.
And this is where psychology and Peterson's first talk in Vancouver 1 comes in, is saying the pattern that you are is going to impact the patterns that you're seeing. It's sort of like if you've ever tried to take video from a moving car on a bumpy road. Well, yeah, there's an objective world out there,
yep.
but your camera's going like this because, and it's only this big, and you are only getting a certain element of the physical, of the light spectrum, and we know this.
Yeah.
So please, you know, I appreciate the fact that part of what we do with science and the scientific image is reduce reality down to certain cause and effect exchanges. That's a powerful thing. It has afforded us technology and science, and all of that is good.
Mm-hmm.
But understand, don't forget the trick that we used to achieve that, and act like we're not using that trick. And that's right. exactly the lie of modernity. And so postmodernity comes along and says, aha, you're liars. Say, okay. But then Lewis basically says, you can see through everything, but the purpose of seeing through things is to actually see something clearly.
Right.
And so then the lie in postmodernity is, you're all seeing lies and you're all telling lies. Okay, well, is that telling of it also a lie? Mm-hmm. You yourself are dissolved by your own solvent, so you have nothing to offer.
Mm-hmm.
So, and this is where, you know, Christians are going to have to learn to embody this truth.
Yeah.
And that's when Christianity becomes impressive.
Yeah. And that's also where Lewis is most quotable, where he's letting the snake bite its own tail. And he says, you know, to continue seeing through everything is to be blind.
Yeah.
It's philosophically slit your own throat.
Yeah.
Yeah, man, that's so good. So Paul, I don't know how familiar you are with like Herman Bavinck. You're in the Reformed Church.
Yep.
Are you a Bavinck guy yourself?
I have been schooled in his tradition, and I'm a product of his tradition. So he and Kuiper are, of course, the two big lights out of which my tradition flows. But I am woefully uneducated in them, partly because I haven't read Dutch. I can't read Dutch. And my grandfather, my grandmother kept whittling down my poor grandfather, retired preacher's bookshelf, until she gave him one shelf that was this big.
Uh-huh.
And so basically all he had left on that shelf were Kuiper and Bavinck and Dutch. And by the time he was too senile to remember what he was reading, he would sit there with Kuiper and Bavinck, and he would always say, I really like Kuiper, but Bavinck is so sweet. So, but I myself have not made my way through. Now, Bavinck has recently been, there's a lot more Kuiper and Bavinck stuff now in English than there ever was when I went to seminary. And so mm-hmm. that stuff is now available, but I have not made my way through it yet.
Yeah. Well, I bring it up. And a lot of, some of my friends are translating that, and it's been fantastic. They come on the podcast, talk about it, but he's been getting at this for a while. The Dutch tradition has been getting at this,
right.
that there's this equal ultimacy between the one and the many. And the one of modernity, the monarchical view, is the one. It's kind of a monism. And then the pluralistic many view is we're all just these little sub-narratives, but there's an incredulity towards meta-narrative, right? And Bavinck and Kuiper and the Dutch tradition has been saying there's an equal ultimacy. Why? Because there's an equal ultimacy in the triune God who made us. He's not more one than he is three, and he's not more three than he is one. So we would expect to find this in reality, this insoluble problem between monarchy and, you know, polyphony or something. And I've just found that so helpful, that plus the archetypal language that he uses. And so it's cool to find that in Jordan Peterson, and he's kind of priming the culture to hear some of this rich Dutch, you know, from your tradition, which is fantastic.
Well, we'll see if the Dutch Reformed can get out of their own way to actually make a contribution. That's usually the problem.
Yeah.
But again, if you think about the So if you look at Kuiper's story, for example, so Kuiper and Bovink are both raised and schooled and educated in the liberal, you know, high liberalism, mm-hmm. and, you know, higher criticism, but it didn't quite have the sophistication in the 19th century that it would grow in the 20th century as it continued to develop. But so they both were steeped in deeply. See, it's the labels are difficult right now because they have changed, deeply theologically, you know, it's high theological liberalism. Mm-hmm. And so Kuiper, of course, is working on that stuff. And then he, as was the case of many young preachers, he'd leave the university and he'd leave his studies and he would have to, you know, he'd have to go to work in a church.
Yeah.
And in a church, suddenly you begin to recognize that all of that theological liberalism is of no use to people, especially in the Netherlands, who are milking cows. You know, this stuff is, you've taken the Bible away from them, but a lot of these people are like, you're taking my Bible over my, you know, cold, dead hands.
Right.
And so what these guys begin to learn in the context of the church is real faith and real piety. And now then they're going to have to say, well, there's some reality to what modernity has brought to the conversation that has to be contended with, but you cannot lose the faith. And so in a lot of ways, Kuiper and Bovink had been dealing with this stuff before Bart, for example.
Yeah.
You know, Bart had the same kind of thing he had to deal with, and people can decide whether, you know, neo-orthodoxy is really a way out of it or not. At Calvin Seminary, when I was there, we weren't taught much neo-orthodoxy because basically they said that it doesn't finally fully help. But Kuiper and Bovink got further in.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's my legacy in the Christian Reformed Church.
Yeah, yeah. Well, so Paul, something that I've been encouraged with in listening to you, and even I listened to your take on William Lane Craig and Jordan Peterson. They're talking about meaning and they got down to morality and stuff like that. And you had mentioned different types of apologetics and how Craig's is a certain type and it's helpful to some people, but there's other types. And that's the other type is what I've been more interested in lately, of reasoning, discourse, the Socratic Club style stuff. And I think that's kind of what you're doing, of presenting a picture of Christianity. But it's, to quote Van Hooser, it's remythologizing theology. It's not taking away the myth. It's not, you know, subjecting it to the third person perspective only, but it's just using different language to flesh out the beauty of it. What role does myth have in helping us with the meaning crisis?
Well, we should ask ourselves, well, what is myth?
Yeah.
Myth is in some ways, you know, archetype and story.
Mm-hmm.
And we are astoundingly mythical creatures. My wife is always frustrated by how big my ego is. And that might not, you know, people that might not necessarily come through on my YouTube channel, but in some ways I cannot live without being a myth. I create myth about myself, and that in a lot of ways is how to address the meaning crisis.
Hmm.
Now, the difficulty we have, and you know, Peterson is wrestling with this in his conversation with Peugeot.
Mm-hmm.
Well, where does the myth and where does the physicality? How do these things meet? That's the question. And of course, with Christ, well, the logos becomes flesh. But I myself am a little myth, and I myself am physical. And, you know, cognitive scientists will also tell us, in terms of our myth making, we develop a lot of BS about ourselves. And that BS about ourselves gets, you know, let's say you're a wrestler and you think, you've learned some moves, you've learned some tricks, you think, I'm the best wrestler around. And so you're wrestling in your high school. And let's say you're at the top of your little division in your city, what have you. Then you go to college. And what do you learn?
It's not the case.
Oh, there's a lot of, they're better wrestlers than me. Suddenly your myth gets, you know, your physicality drops your myth down.
It's a little too close to home here, Paul.
But hey, but now meaning, because you say, if I really want to be the best wrestler in the NCAA, if that's, I don't know if that's the, what, you know,
that's right.
Need to, well, what do you need to do then? You need to train. You need to discipline yourself. You need to diet. You need to, you know, hit the weight room. You need to do all of these things. And there are cheap, you know, there are cheats along the way, like, oh, I need to get on roids. Yeah. Okay, you may get some muscle now, but, you know, when you're 30 or 40, you're going to pay for that. Yeah. So, so myth is something that it's out there in the big world, but it's also inside of us. Mm-hmm. And so we do have to, in some ways, remythologize and live in the world of myth for us to finally, you know, if Michael Jordan, you know, one of the best NBA players that we've ever seen, you know, not that tall, mm-hmm. not that strong, you know, very, you know, obviously a top athlete, right. But I'm sure there've been many who are more athletic than him. Mm-hmm. You know, he, in some ways, and when you listen to that, that thing that you can, you know, that long documentary that was released fairly soon.
Yeah.
He's a very mythical being, mm-hmm. Michael Jordan is, and he never would have achieved what he did on the physical basketball court without that mythical aspect to him. Mm-hmm. And so any human being that actually accomplishes something dramatically excellent, it's often because they're fairly mythical.
That is such a great point. That comes, that happens in wrestling all the time, where, I mean, if you looked at him, if you looked at these two wrestlers in the world of things and you looked at their oxygen levels and their blood and all this stuff, you could say this guy's going to win. And then the other thing happens and the other guy wins because he believed it about himself. And he thought, I'm the best dude around. You're like, you're actually not, you shouldn't beat this. You have no business beating this guy. And then he beats him. And it's like, well, what happened? How are you able to do that? And it's like a weird self-deception, or like you just believe this. And because you believed it, it's helped you beat this other guy. Yeah. That's an important point. That's crazy.
And we love it in sports. That's why we watch. Mm-hmm. And it's why we look at movies. Because that's the story of movies. It's because this guy should win. Why do we cheer for the underdog? Because the underdog is mythic.
Yeah.
And the other guy is just physicality.
Yeah. Well, and Paul, in a sense, that's also like an archetypal myth of the underdog. And right. And we root for them, and we want to see that instantiated on the basketball court as it is in the football or on the wrestling mat. Or in the business world, or in the stock market, depending on what stocks you're holding. But yeah, that's really interesting. So that's what we have with myth. Does Peterson's conception of myth differ significantly from Lewis's?
That's a really good question. I don't know the answer to that. I haven't had that sense. Peterson... Yeah, that's a really good question.
Well, in my read, so I think I understand Peterson's more than I understand Lewis's, and Peterson's is on this hierarchy of or this developmental ladder, and you know, you have action first, and it's acted out by all your ancestors, and then we kind of start to form words, and we acquire language, and then we don't have the conceptual tools yet to abstract out truth from our action, which has been passed down, but we can make myths, and myth comes before religion, and religion comes before philosophy. And I think maybe philosophy is kind of the top tier where we're able to abstract out in fine grained detail.
Philosophers think that. I think religion finally trumps philosophy.
Yeah, I think so too. I think so too. But maybe he's thinking conceptually or something. But Lewis's myth, he's so into Norse mythology and stuff like that. I'm not sure if it's the same conception or not.
Well, Peterson definitely tries to tell the story, the evolutionary development story of maybe an account of where myth might come from below.
Yeah.
And Peterson's Peterson's attempt at doing that definitely gives him credibility among the those who sort of like to think of themselves as atheists.
Yeah.
Lewis follows Chesterton more in some skepticism about that story.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I don't think I don't have a problem with Peterson pursuing that, because I think if there's something we can see about this world, it's that God works through process.
Mm.
And so highlighting the process does not necessarily take God out of the equation. That's sort of where, in some ways, in the 19th and 20th century, had this big fight between modernists and fundamentalists.
Yep.
Because basically, as knowledge kept moving forward, we saw more and more processes behind the world that we arrived at. Mm-hmm. Fundamentalists wanted to imagine when God speaks the world into being, things sort of pop into the world like in I Dream of Jeannie.
Right.
I don't even find that in the Bible.
Hmm.
Because if you read Genesis 1, you know, let the sea bring forth,
let the ground bring forth. Exactly.
He calls this order, you know, he calls this differentiation out of the raw material.
Mm-hmm.
And so I don't see, I think the fundamentalist instinct of trying to protect God by turning God into Barbara Eden and I Dream of Jeannie doesn't help the case.
Right.
And so Peterson wants to track, he wants to look for the footprints of this. And yeah, fair enough. Lewis and Chesterton, and Lewis especially in Miracles, you know, his argument is that, you know, God is coming down with reason and reason is colonizing matter.
Yeah.
And then the grand miracle, the central chapter where, you know, where Logos main, you know, becomes flesh, comes down into and pulls everything up with him. I think that's much more Lewis's. So I think Lewis would be skeptical, and I think rightly so, that we're going to be able to actually account for myth finally and fully, just like reason. And again, reason in Lewis's book Miracles does a lot of weight, does a lot of carrying.
Yeah.
And, you know, Luther might be a little more skeptical, but this, we're getting pretty far down into the weeds with this.
Yeah.
But I think it's fair. So in some ways, Peterson wants to sort of construct a Tower of Babel,
mm-hmm.
but the Tower of Babel story still governs in that you're not, oh man, you're forgetting who you are. Yeah. You're not going to get it up to the sky.
Mm-hmm.
It's, and there's a God in heaven who finally might, you know, say, wow, pretty impressive. But, you know, even what we would think now, how high of a tower can you build to heaven? Well, heaven isn't just above the atmosphere.
Yeah.
You don't have what it takes to do that construction.
Yeah. Yeah. And even still, even if Peterson is right, a good Calvinist can say, well, God ordains the ends and the means. And so, you know, when I would think of and read Joseph Campbell and the myth, the hero with 1,000 faces, you can go one of two directions. You can go the naturalistic route and go, see, Christ is just another instantiation. Or you could say, see, the whole world has been about this. And every good story has to have creation, fall, redemption, and consummation in order to make a good story. Because that's the kind of beings we've been made. We've been made in this, the image of the being who told the greatest story.
Yeah.
And so it kind of just has to do with your prior commitments there. But I do think I'm tempted to agree with Lewis that there is something supernatural about that. I think even more so in our language and our ability to form concepts. And I think, you know, you start tracing that back and you either get to, this is where Lewis says about reason, you can have reason coming from reason. But if you have reason coming from non-reason, we got to cry halt.
Right.
And I think the similar thing with language, you know, you have language all the way back to a God who taught Adam how to speak and he was actually forming concepts with him. However he did that, whether it was, you know, took a evolved being and then said, this is the one that I'm going to make Adam, or whether it was a people group, or whether it was young Earth, you know, either way, we have to have God triangulating with the creature. And then we get concepts you and I are talking today with it. Or you have non-concepts and non-language giving rise to language and concepts. And that is much harder to believe for me.
Well, especially because what in the, I mean, even when we say, well, God took a, we almost fall into the trap of saying God was just walking around and found it as if it came from somewhere else. And no, it didn't come from anywhere else. And the same with, and so, conversations with Verveke about this, and that's sort of where a lot of our conversations have gone. I have no problem. Go for it. Push this stuff as far back as you can.
Yeah.
But the potentiality in the building blocks that you are seeing something emerge from, who built that potentiality into the entire framework out of which this would come?
Right.
I mean, because at some point you bump into the question, that potentiality had to be in, push it all the way back to the Big Bang or to, you know, inorganic molecules. That potentiality had to be there for it to emerge.
Yeah.
So you're still not out of the box.
Yeah.
And even if you've got someone really smart like James Tour, who's like, y'all are just waving your hand saying, well, if we throw these inorganic, you know, elements and compounds together, that life comes out. You even have the blueprint and you can't do it. So stop talking about, oh, we all know that this just happens.
Right.
And that there, and then the more interesting question for me is always, what are we so afraid of?
Yeah.
Of saying this stuff is owned by someone. Why that terror? And I think that is exactly what we find with Adam and Eve hiding in the garden. That's the terror.
Yeah.
Because now suddenly, oh, we look around at this garden and we can own this place. But then the owner shows up and we know we're outclassed. We can't compete with this. And so then we hide and we play games and we deny and we, you know, have all these, and you can do the psychology on that stuff too. We do all of those games. And at some point that, because the sheer terror is, what if the owner of all of this stuff isn't finally for us? Because we can't compete. We can't withstand. And then death and nihilism is the only is the only hope we have.
Yeah.
And Christianity comes and says, well, I have good news for you, that he made you for glory. And if you'd stop, if you'd please stop the idiocy, you can know that glory and you can know the King of glory. And so open your gates and let him come in.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the glorious news of the gospel.
Man, amen. I don't know if it's in Mere Christianity or a different work, but Lewis talks about dread and this kind of dread feeling. It's probably Mere Christianity. You're talking about ghosts, and you've brought this out in some of your work as well. And it's like there's a force here.
Problem of pain.
Okay, problem of pain. And it's a personal force, and that's terrifying because there's a person here. And exactly what you said, and whoever, there's probably all sorts of psychological states going on. Maybe I've trespassed. Or maybe I owe him something, or maybe he's bad and he's going to torture me forever. But yeah, the good news, and I like how you flesh that out. So I think ultimately your answer to the meaning crisis, you say one word, it's glory, right? That's your answer.
Yeah. And it's joy.
Yeah. Glory and joy. And those encompass inherent to those are meaning, but the pinnacle is the joy and the glory.
Yeah.
Paul, we kind of fleshed out the difference between the meaning crisis for women and men and how women have a biological advantage over men, especially in this culture. Is glory the same answer for both men and women? Is it fleshed out differently, or is that ultimately both men and women are the meaning crisis is solved for both in glory?
Well, so think about glory in this way. Glory is a funny thing. someone produces a cake, let's say, and let's say it's a world-class baker. So glory isn't a static thing. Glory is a drama. And so let's imagine this cake baker bakes a cake, puts it in front of a group of people and says, I bake this, eat it. It's good, isn't it? It's good, isn't it? It might be a great cake. Let's imagine the baker putting it on a table, walking behind one-way glass and watching. Mm. Someone sees the cake and cuts a slice and says, oh, this is amazing. Mm. And then, hey, come here. Try this. Isn't it good? Notice how glory multiplies with humility.
Yeah.
And how glory is spoiled. And so, you know, the power that human beings have in this world follows this glory. And I don't see a whole lot of difference. You know, they're men and women, you know, men and women are sort of like this.
Yeah.
You know, we got so much in common.
Yeah.
And we got these few things that differentiate
us. That's really good. I like that.
Men are, you know, we're a little bit bigger, we're a little bit physically stronger, we don't live as long. Maybe just because I'm a man, I think we're a little simpler or not as sophisticated.
Sure.
Women are, you know, a little bit smaller, not as physically strong, but their bodies are more durable. They live longer than us. They're more sophisticated, more relationally sophisticated in some ways. And so we're really close to each other. And, you know, sexually, we provide one piece, they provide the other. And I think that's absolute genius, because what it means is that we've got this creature that is just so close to us, but we can't actually find our potential without figuring out how to relate to the other. And, the marriage and figuring that out. And, you know, there's no end to the competition between men and women. It just goes deeper than we can go. But, and I think actually in that, you know, it's interesting to see how often the Bible riffs on that, because, you know, Christ and the church, Christ and his bride, you know, Ephesians 5, men and women. And, but that's always balanced with other things. I mean, Jesus, to the best of our knowledge, was single. The Apostle Paul, to the best of our knowledge, was single. And so that keeps from making biological union the ultimate. No, right. It's a second order good. It's a wonderful good, but it's not, you can be single. You don't have to procreate. There are higher goods that can be, but creation is fractal in how these things get laid out.
Mm.
And so, yeah, men and women, we'll keep working on that puzzle until Jesus comes. And then Jesus says, you know, something about, you know, won't be, you know, married or given in marriage in the age to come. And it's like, oh gosh, how to get our minds around that one.
Right.
But okay. We'll trust God for the sexual arrangements of the age to come.
Right.
We'll leave that to him. But until now, it's like God, you know, the best kinds of puzzles are the ones that, if you have a puzzle that's absolutely unsolvable, you'll work on it for a while and you'll throw it away in frustration.
Mm-hmm.
If you have a puzzle that's partially solvable and it's like, oh, so then you have the aha and the achievement, but then you realize, oh, there's more to it. And then you do it some more and then you stop. Oh, and you know, it's sort of like Bitcoin. The more you mine, the harder it is to get more. And reality seems to be made that way.
Yeah.
And it's for that reason that I think all of the atheists that say, oh, eternity with God would be boring, and so that would be torture. And I think, oh, you don't know my God. You don't know the levels to which he goes. And, you know, even someone like Neil deGrasse Tyson, in a very interesting video, says, well, there's this funny dynamic about the more that you know, the more you know you don't know.
Right.
And this world, this creation 1.0 has that dynamic. How much more won't creation 2.0 continue that? And that then gives gives really encourages me that the life for which Christ is preparing us now, we will go further up and further in.
Amen.
And because our God is inexhaustible, our life pursuing him into eternity also will not be exhausted. And that's a very good thought.
I think that's fantastic. And even if we didn't have the future, the promise of the future, you know, Earth 2.0, Universe 2.0 to explore forever, we could explore the past forever. All the different perspectives, you could see all the little micro dramas happening between this frog, you know, about to starve to death and finds the caterpillar just in time, or the angels battling demons to get some message to someone. The whole universe, this theodrama, is made up of all these billions of smaller dramas we could explore and get to know our God and how he acts to save and to be just again and again and again and again. And that would be ultimate. That would be so meaningful and so interesting for eternity. But yet we do have 2.0 to continue living as well. So Paul, to finish up here, is glory something that we can have now? Can we ever finish that puzzle? Can we be in that state? You said it's not static, but can we be living in that story of glory now? Or do we, like Lewis, are we made for a different story that we'll experience when the archetype comes back again, when Christ returns and inaugurates the eschaton, I guess?
We're in the foothills. I think that's what Christian theology about the now and the not yet tells us. Mm-hmm. That we begin to taste it, but of course glory is something too large for us to, you know, this is my whole illustration about the cake. We can't wield glory. Mm-hmm. What we do is we sort of build the altar like Elijah on Carmel and say, it's up to you, Lord.
Hmm.
You know, show us your glory. I think this is why Moses, you know, says, you know, I want to see your face. And God says, you're not ready for my face yet.
Yeah.
I'll give you a taste. You're not ready for my face yet. And I think that's where we're at. We're not ready for his face yet.
Hmm.
And of course, Lewis's best novel, Till We Have Faces,
yeah,
you know, explores that to a degree.
Mm-hmm.
But we're not, you know, glory, joy, they're gifts. They're gifts. Yeah. And so what we have to learn is, first of all, to stop grabbing, stop punching, open our hands to receive, and trust that our Heavenly Father has good things for us.
Mm-hmm.
And he will raise us up and grow us up to be ready for his face.
Yeah. Amen. I like your answer is glory as well, because it's also an apologetic for evangelism. And you've talked about this. I always think of, you know, you eat a really good steak, and if someone said you're not allowed to talk about it ever, the whole experience would be diminished, because I want to talk about the steak. I want to talk about the cook. I want to talk about the experience. I want to talk about how much it cost, how juicy it was, how you should go there as well. And that's really what evangelism is supposed to be.
That's right.
Yeah. And that's why I appreciate the apologetic that you're taking of come and taste and see through dialogue, through discourse. And I'm not going to be offended if you say some heretical crap. That's okay. I'm a big boy. Let's talk. And that's what I appreciate about you, man. And I'm seeking to emulate that as well. Paul, if people wanted to get to know this glory answer more and to get to know more of your stuff, where can they find you at?
Up my YouTube channel, which is just Paul Vanderclay.
Mm-hmm.
And if you just go to Google and type in Paul Vanderclay, or YouTube and type in Paul Vanderclay, it reliably brings me up. And
awesome.
I usually do about 6 videos a week, so I've got a tremendous amount of content out
yep.
there.
Yep.
But yeah, yeah. That's just like, you know, when you started talking about the shape of my project right now. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's awesome. Well, man, I really appreciate the work you're doing. And I hope this has been just kind of a start to a conversation, because there's so much that you have to say that I would love to talk with you more on. So please come back and regale us more with more of the wisdom from the white beard there.
Okay.
Well, awesome. Hopefully this conversation will continue, but for now it's going to have to do it. This has been Parker's Pensies. And as always, all glory